The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly and I'm Anne Perkins. From Portugal to Poland, EU citizens cast their votes and the results were not pretty. Joining the diminished majority of mainstream right and left blocs in the European Parliament are a hotchpotch of anti-EU, quasi-fascists and extremists. What does it all mean for the once noble EU project? Back in Britain, it was another calamity for Nick Clegg, who now faces serious questions over his leadership of the Lib Dems as they lose all but one of their representatives in Brussels. Joining me for all of this are Guardian columnist Martin Kettle and Hugh Muir. Welcome to you both. Now, these were pan-European elections, but they were in a large part used by voters to give their national governments a good kicking. And in Britain, most of the blows were dealt to the junior coalition members of the Liberal Democrats. Martin, Nick Clegg decided to take on Nigel Farage and the case for Europe. Does the result show where Britain stands on the question of Europe?
I think it shows where Britain stands on the question of Nick Clegg rather than the question of Europe. I don't think the European elections are fundamentally about Europe at all. They're fought entirely on the domestic agenda here. Across Europe, they were fought a bit more on the European agenda, but that barely penetrated across the channel. All the parties here tried to keep it away. And so that the Farage and UKIP success, which is significant and major and a big development in British politics, is nevertheless, I think, essentially domestic development. It's about it's a protest vote because everybody likes to have a protest vote at the European elections because they're not treated as a serious exercise of democracy, and that's an important thing, the protest vote. But they're also a way of hitting the system, particularly I think in the wake of the economic crisis and the sense that many people feel that they are both materially and, if you like, culturally out of sync, that the system is out of sync with their lives.
I just wonder though that if there wasn't a moment when Clegg might have made a better case for Europe, accepting what you say, that Europe wasn't really the pointed issue. But he's been criticised, and it seems to be quite reasonably, for kind of not having an idea about Europe, not having a kind of vision for a different and more modern Europe. When he was asked how Europe would look in 5 years' time, and he said much the same as now, that was arguably a misstep.
I think that's certainly true. Nick Clegg is the one sort of true believer of the party leaders in the European project as it's existed for the last 20, 30 years. You know, he is a European through and through. And in that sense, he's very different. But of course, Europe has changed and these elections have changed Europe, and the agenda in Europe is a changing agenda. And in many ways, the agenda is moving towards a real clash between a reformist agenda, which is to some extent decentralizing, and the continuing momentum, such as it is, and there is some, for the traditional federalist Brussels-centered agenda, which, you know, is basically about creating a United States of Europe.
Hugh, sticking to the domestic implications of the result for a moment, do you think that the political mould is now completely shattered and that we're entering an era of prolonged coalition government as three or four parties contend for seats?
I think it certainly looks that way. I'm not convinced by
claims that were being made as the results came in that we are in this new era of four-party politics. We're probably maybe in a period of four-party politics, but I'm not sure how long the kind of UKIP contribution will last. I mean, is this a protest that will happen and then dissipate over time, or have they actually broken the mould? I think that's yet to be proven. Do they have the policies? Do they have the infrastructure? There's a lot they have to do now. Having come this far, there is a lot they have to achieve to actually become a sustainable party in the long run. And you wonder if they will have the money for that. Of course, you know, success breeds many friends, and so maybe some money will gravitate their way, and maybe some people of high ability who can construct a party will come their way. But we have the system that we have for a reason. It's very hard to break into that. You know, what's been the two-party system and now the three-party system. But look how long it's been for us to actually have a sustainable third party. So I think the idea that there's a sure thing fourth party now established that will be there for decades to come, I'm not at all convinced by that.
How do you think the party should respond to UKIP's appeal? Is it the appeal of Farage, or is it saying something different to the parties about the way they conduct politics?
I think that he's almost had the appeal of the wayward boyfriend. You know, Dawn might bring home the wayward boyfriend, and he looks all exciting, and you know, things he does are bad, and he talks rubbish, but he's really exciting, and so looks quite attractive. And I think it's really been difficult for more sober-sided politicians to cope with that. I think that, you should choose my words carefully, but I think there's been a degree of charlatanism about UKIP. I think that they've been fast and loose with figures. I think Tony Blair was right. Oh my God, I said that. But when he said, you know, you lift the surface and there's something a bit nasty and unpleasant underneath. And so you then have to say, well, why has the British public gone for that? I think that there's been a deal of cowardice amongst the other parties, and that they thought, well, either we take this guy on, Or we try and be a lighter version of him and adopt his arguments. And I think they've chosen to adopt his arguments. The problem with that being that, you know, he will play best on his own territory. If he's chosen the territory, then he will perform the best on it. And that's really what happened. What to do? I see the UKIP as being pretty much an extremist party. And the way that you deal with extremists really is to look at the most moderate element of their support and suck it away. And I think that's what will happen. I think that there will be people who aren't natural UKIP supporters in terms of looking at its whole programme, but rely on UKIP to get them certain things in Europe and certain things in terms of migration. And it's down now to the major parties to satisfy those people.
So what does that mean, Martin? What does that mean, particularly in terms of how Labour should tackle some of the issues that UKIP's made their own? I mean, that's Labour did well on the face of it, but arguably not nearly as well as they might have done. They perhaps should have done.
Well, they did best. I mean, I think that's worth saying. And it's interesting in this discussion, you know, we started off by talking about the impact on the Lib Dems, and they're doing badly. But actually, everybody took a hit, and certainly the Tories took a hit as well as Labour. So, you know, I think it's quite important that we have quite a kind of three-dimensional conversation about all these issues, and not just focus on one particular party. I think that Hugh is right, and I'm happy to say that Tony Blair is right. You know, that you do have to talk to the UKIP supporters in rational terms and not just tick them off. And you can, I think, win back quite a lot of that support. And clearly there is there's the protest element. So, you know, I think quite a proportion of the UKIP vote is not going to stay with UKIP. But and all the surveys do suggest that the UKIP vote is a bit more tenacious this time around than it was after 2009 and than it was after 2004. And it just begins to look as though about half of those voters are going to stick with UKIP. And, you know, if UKIP wins in the Newark by-election, that will be bolstered. And so, you know, one's beginning to look at a situation where perhaps about 10% of people vote UKIP at the general election. Now, that is very good news for Labour, not very bad news for Labour, because primarily that's going to cut back the Tory vote. And so, you know, as the polling has been showing in the marginals, that does look quite good for Ed Miliband. On a longer term basis, I think what is really at stake is how this country can move from having a debate about immigration, which is a fearful debate about the threat from immigration, to a debate which is more measured and much more about the need for immigration and the benefits of immigration. You know, that's a debate which every country in Western Europe has to have. It's been part of the whole European election over the last month in every country in Europe. And you only have to look at the conversation that goes on in Germany about this, which is conducted in very different terms, which is conducted always in terms of the need for immigration, the need for more people in work paying taxes to pay for the social benefits which the demographically declining native Germans are going to want as they retire and live longer lives. And the same applies in most of the Western world.
I think there's some wider lessons here, though. I agree with almost everything that you say, but I also think that before the parties are able to address what is basically a two-policy programme, isn't it, the EU and migration, but before those are both really sensitive, sticky issues, and before politicians can deal with that, they also have to deal with their estrangement from the electorate. Because to be able to deal with issues like that, you know, you have to have some level of trust. And of course, that is the problem, in that whatever they say now is not going to be listened to. I actually make the case for Nick Clegg in this area, in that I think the fact that he at least wanted to take Nigel Farage on, I think was a good thing. He maybe didn't do it particularly well when it came to the debates, but I think that the instinct was right. But I think that generally there needs to be this wider process. And to his credit, Ed Miliband does seem to realise that you just have to have re-establish a rapport with the electorate, and they will then maybe listen to you on these issues.
Just one little thing. I mean, I agree with that. I think it's a really, really good point. It's interesting that in Scotland, Alex Salmond has said this week, he's set out a thing about the extra migration that an independent Scotland would need. Now, what Salmond has got, which Nick Clegg hasn't got, is standing. He's got the standing in Scotland to say that, and for people not to sort of go running away saying, you know, that everything's going to, you know, go to hell in a handcart. The problem in Britain is that there is no single politician who has the standing to say those things and to be listened to without everybody pressing the panic button.
Least of all at the moment, Nick Clegg, Hugh and then Martin, just briefly, how damaging has this Oakeshott thing been? Can he survive? Will the coalition last for another year? And will Clegg lead the party into the election?
I think he will survive, because there isn't much of an alternative. In fact, if there was an alternative, it looks even less of an alternative today, because Vince Cable emerges from this with some damage. And he would have been the obvious choice. I mean, you can maybe look to people like Tim Farron, but would they really want to do that this close to the election? But there are fundamental questions for them. Because I think Nick Clegg can say, well, I'm not really doing anything different to that which I promised. I haven't really changed direction that much over the past year. You knew when we went into government that we would be involved in some pretty ugly stuff. And we made a judgment that would we rather be in government for the first time in almost a century and take everything that comes with that, but establish ourselves as a credible party in an era where this is likely to see coalitions and actually have some influence and move the country towards liberalism in that way, or would we rather not and be able to pat ourselves on the back for being ideologically pure, but actually have no impact? People made that decision. Maybe they're going to have to think that through and make that decision again.
I think history will be much kinder to Nick Clegg than the present is. I think that he will survive. I think he should survive. I think the Liberal Democrats will suffer at the general election. And if I can just put in a plug for something I read this morning, the polling which on which a lot of this is based, I think is pretty dubious. And there's a very, very good deconstruction of it on the Servation website, which really takes it apart and suggests, in fact, that Nick Clegg himself is not in danger of losing his seat in Hallam, and that the possibility that the Lib Dems all face a wipeout under Nick Clegg is, in fact, untrue.
It was certainly a pretty malicious use of statistics, wasn't it? Well, if UKIP's purple colours are spreading across the map in Britain, some distinctly more sinister parties were in the ascendancy in the rest of Europe. The most alarming news came from France, where the far-right party, the Front National, topped the poll. Our correspondent in Paris is Kim Wilshire.
Marine Le Pen, as we know, has spent years since she took over from the party, took over the party from her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, trying to, as she puts it in French, demonise it, which has been to soften its image, to get away from the idea that this is a party that's represented by, or represents, the sort of neo-Nazi thugs, and get away from this idea that it is extreme, and indeed has threatened, though I'm not sure she has ever succeeded in a legal action, but she has threatened to sue anyone who calls the party the extreme right or calls it fascist. It's a party that is fundamentally opposed to immigration. It's fundamentally opposed to Europe. It wishes to tear up the Schengen Agreement. In many ways, has the same aims as UKIP. It wishes to wrest back sovereign issues to national government. She did indeed get a very high score, but it was 25% of the 40% who voted. The abstention rate was very high. And again, there are arguments over whether this was a protest vote. But it cannot be taken away from Marine Le Pen and the Front National that they did poll a historic high, and she does have 24 MEPs in the European Parliament, compared with 3 in 2009.
Meanwhile, has left to Italy for what was arguably the best news of the week for Social Democrats. Lizzie Davis is in Rome for The Guardian. She says the results were a boon for Italy's new Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi.
He now has a kind of mandate, which is what he's been lacking ever since he took power earlier this year in a kind of palace coup. So he had never, despite what he had said before, he had become prime minister without having the blessing of the popular vote. Now, after having gained more than 40% in these European elections, he does have a mandate. He does appear to have got the popular blessing. So the implications for him are that he emerges from this much stronger, much more well-equipped to embark on the sweeping reforms that he has promised Italy. And the implications for Europe are also interesting. I mean, this could be the beginning of a profound shift in dynamics now, because Renzi's success has come at the same time as François Hollande's dismal performance in France. So it could be seen as Renzi as emerging as the most important centre-left leader in Europe, who may be capable of tackling Angela Merkel on some of the what we've come to see as kind of EU dogmas over the past couple of years. And Italy is taking over the presidency in July of the EU, and you can expect to be hearing a lot from him and from a country that has long been considered the problem child of the major EU economies, you know, the basket case, the country that can never get its house in order. It could be the start of something quite different.
And Angela Merkel, German Chancellor, was one of the other winners from Sunday's vote, as our Berlin correspondent Philip Altman explains.
Arguably, the vote in Germany was the least spectacular on the continent, you might say. Merkel's party, the CDU, and their sister party, the CSU in Bavaria, they won the overall majority. They didn't do very well compared to the last election, and they particularly lost votes in Bavaria, but they got 30%. The Social Democrats did fairly well, got 27 0.3%, and that's really the big picture. I mean, people have been looking closely at the anti-Euro party that was only set up a couple of years ago, Alternative für Deutschland, which is commonly known as the AfD nowadays. They got 7%, which is considerable. They were asked, their party, the Bernd Lucke, was asked on the night on German television whether he would consider going into an alliance with UKIP. His answer was a pretty definite no. He's very keen to sit with the Tories, which would be problematic for Cameron, because he doesn't want to. Saying that, there are part members of his party who are very keen on UKIP. Their youth wing had Farage over in Cologne earlier this year, and there are members in the party who've been calling for a party ballot on whether to sit with Farage's lot. In Germany, I think compared to Britain, people have paid close attention to the process, Spitzenkandidaten, or the sort of new system of having lead candidates for the post of the European Commission president, and that's a process that people have taken quite seriously here in the media, and in a way perhaps it hasn't been followed as closely in Britain. And it means that there's quite a lot of pressure now on Merkel both from the newspapers here, but also from the Social Democrats to honour that commitment to this new process, and not choose the new European Commission president through some kind of backroom deal. So it's I think she's actually in quite a tight spot at the moment, because she will have to either annoy Cameron, or she will have to annoy large parts of the German public.
That's an interesting point that Philip Altman made, that these new powers are going to at least shake up the way Europe's managed.
Well, that's certainly true. I think what Philip was talking about is something that there's been an election campaign with these Spitzenkandidaten, the leaders of the different political groups that existed within the old European Parliament. But Merkel this week in Brussels made it pretty clear that she's not going to just fall into line on that, and she basically played for time. She said that we'll have to have a look at all this, and we can't just assume that this system is going to be the only is going to produce the answer. So I think when push comes to shove, I think that Merkel actually puts keeping the UK in the European Union, and thus preserving the sense that the European Union is a continuing and growing force rather than one which is disintegrating, I think she puts that at the top of her agenda. And that's a very useful thing from the Tories' point of view, of course. But so I think that in the end, the effort is going to be to find somebody who, as the successor to Manuel Barroso as Commission President, they're going to have to find someone pretty heavyweight. There's quite a lot of suggestion that possibly someone like Pascal Lamy, the former trade commissioner from the EU, or Christine Lagarde, currently at the IMF, might be the kind of person who could step into those shoes. So
I thought Tony Blair was pitching for the job.
I think Tony Blair is pitching for the job, and I notice that he's focusing in on Europe.
But personally,
I think he would bring quite a lot of strength to that. But I mean, he is too controversial a figure. He's for all the reasons that we know. And I think that actually in the end, he didn't get it last time, and I don't think he's going to get it this time unless he's done some pretty clever work with Merkel.
I think there'd be huge pushback to that. But in a way, we've come to, I think, a good place in a bad way. And I think that if this means that we have to have almost reach a new settlement about Europe, then I think it will be a good thing. I'm kind of tiring of this kind of being in it but not quite being in it, and never really knowing what it is that we want from it, and the poor quality of debate that we have about Europe is just makes you want to scream. And so I think if Mr. Farage and UKIP and all of the extremist parties throughout Europe have brought us to a point where we actually do have to look at it again, then I think that that's a good thing. I'm not sure. I don't like having all these uglies elected in Europe, but I'm not sure they can do that much damage. I'll certainly be looking to see which of them Nigel Farage decides to cozy up with. I think as we speak, he's trying to work out what his group will be and who will be in it. I think that will be very interesting. But, you know, I think that ahead of the referendum that we're going to have, it will just be a real relief just to have a settlement. It doesn't really matter how long it lasts, does it? But just to say, this is where we are now.
We've got two really difficult, hard-to-control forces at work. You've got the kind of sort of Europe-wide disenchantment. You've also got this need to make the euro work, which is demanding a completely different kind of response.
But I think it's a really interesting, ironic ending to this turbulent week or month of European politics, that just as all these anti-system, anti-EU, Eurosceptic parties have done very well in Europe, what is the net result in British public opinion about attitudes to membership of the EU? It's that Britain has not in recent years been more pro-membership of the EU in the polls than it is today. Now, I mean, that in a sense is Nigel Farage's unexpected achievement. Remember, we've lived for, what is it, 30 years or so with the Murdoch Sun, the Dacre Daily Mail, the Telegraph, continually saying that everything about the European project is bogus and unacceptable and a conspiracy. Now, you know, that's a headwind that we've all been struggling with the whole time, and it's still there. But in a funny way, when you get down to it and people have to start talking about what's the best deal for Britain, what's the best deal for Europe, what's the best arrangement, you get a much more pro-European thing, because people actually think we're better together, if I can coin a phrase from the Scottish campaign. And, you know, that's what happened when we did have a referendum in 1975. You know, it came off the back of a feeling that Britain was going to reject membership, but in fact we voted 2-1. And I think that however we get there, we're going to get somewhere similar if and when we do have a referendum. I'm not so sure we're going to have a referendum, Hugh, because I don't think there will be a Tory government at the end of the next general election.
In a way, it'd be a shame, because I just would like some forum to look at this. And I think when we do that, we've got to talk about the present, but I also think we should talk about the past. And I think we should not forget the first principles as to why we have the EU in the first place.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Hugh Muir and Martin Kettle. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anne Perkins. Thanks for listening.